Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our weekly Landis-Sky Regional Council COVID-19 response calls. We've been hosting these calls since late March, since the COVID-19 restrictions went into place to try to help our region better respond to the challenges brought on by COVID-19. And we really appreciate your participation in today's calls. We hope these calls are informative to our local governments, to our communities, to help us find out where we have gaps in resources and other areas where perhaps we could collaborate better to respond to this health and economic crisis. Just some housekeeping before the call, before we get the call started. This call is taped, so we tried to place the recorded versions on our website. We've had a few technical difficulties, so there may be a call or two that we don't have on our website, but you can go to our Landis-Sky website at landis-sky.org, and on our homepage we have a COVID-19 link, and you can find the links for these meetings. So these calls are recorded, and we want everyone to know that. All the participants who join the calls will be muted, so we have to unmute you for our end, and that's just for security purposes. Also, we unfortunately aren't able to allow our participants to share screens during these calls for security purposes. We're fortunate today to have Drew Christie with the governor's office. Drew's been really gracious to give of his time and provide an update at many of these calls, so we'll turn the call over to him very shortly. Also, Chris Wall with EQV Strategic will be joining us, and Chris represents the North Carolina Association of Regional Council of Government. So he'll give us an update of what's happening from Raleigh and also D.C. We're really honored today to have Thomas Stith, who's the director of the North Carolina Small Business Administration. The Small Business Administration has really been in the forefront of the response, certainly based on the funding available through the CARES Act to support small businesses that have been impacted. And so we look forward to hearing the work from Thomas and his team and about the work they're doing across our state and in the Landis-Sky region. And then finally, we're honored. We'll have Joe McKinney with the National Association of Development Organizations, NADO, will be with us from D.C. Joe leads the NADO organization, and that's the organization that represents organizations like Landis-Sky, local development districts all across the state. And Joe is a former executive director of Landis-Sky, so we appreciate him joining us today. But I'll begin the call by turning it over to Drew Christie with Governor Roy Cooper's office. Drew, thank you for joining us, and thank you for taking time to share the latest updates from Raleigh and from Governor Cooper.
Thank you, Nathan, for having me, and thank you, Landis-Sky Regional Council, for hosting, and thank everyone that's attending this call. It shows all your dedication to your individual areas, and so we thank you so much for that. Today at 2:00, so right after this call, Governor Cooper will be holding a press conference to talk about COVID-19 updates. So you can view that through the Department of Health and Human Services website or State Emergency Management website, or if you're at home, you can view it on the local PBS channel. So to start off with, we always want to remind people the 3 W's: wear a face mask, wash your hands frequently for at least 20 seconds, and wait 6 feet apart. So I'm gonna go into kind of 3 different areas here briefly. So as of today, there have been 48,188 confirmed cases in North Carolina, with 1,175 deaths. Hospital rates keep climbing. That is not a good thing. There are currently 857 people in hospital beds due to COVID-19. So we need to continue to, and the governor and Secretary Cohen will cover more about this today, but that's something we need to keep an eye on. The next thing I'll talk about is unemployment rates. Currently, there have been 1,546,129 claims filed since March 15th. And as of yesterday, there were 111,000 dollars paid out. So we're getting money out. We're working on it. Prior Gibson had took over for Secretary Taylor, and Secretary Taylor had done a great job. And so Pryor's trying to build on the work that he has done to get more payments out to folks. And let me see here. Boom. Moving on here, the North Carolina Rapid Recovery Program, which is grant applications done through the Golden Leaf Foundations. Statewide, there have been 7,100 applications for a total of $224 million requested. It's average requested rate of $31,303. So that's good that the Golden Leaf Foundation is trying to get money out to historically underutilized businesses and borrowers and to all businesses out there. So 60% or 61% of all borrowers are minority or female owned or historically underutilized businesses, which is approximately 31%. So that's good numbers there. And the last thing I want to cover, it's not directly COVID related, but it's somewhat, it's talk about the U.S. Census. So there's not been a great response rate to the census. And to put that, or to contextualize that, both Transylvania counties and Madison counties will, and these numbers are based on the May 31st response rates. So Madison counties and Transylvania counties are expected to lose about $250,000 every year because we're not meeting our census rate targets. Henderson County is expected to lose close to $5 million a year, and Buncombe County is expected to lose close to $12 million a year because we are not meeting our census targets. So just putting that out there for everybody to help kind of spread the word to try and get people to respond to the census questions. And with that, Nathan, I'll turn it back over to you.
Thank you so much, Drew, and I appreciate you reminding us about the importance of the census. So we encourage all our community partners, employers, local governments, and other organizations to encourage their team members, their neighbors, others to respond to the census because you're right, North Carolina is lagging compared to the nation, and our region is lagging compared to the state. So those numbers, I can't pull them off the top of my head, but I think, you know, Henderson ranks around 25th in the 100 counties in the state in response rates. Buncombe's around in the around number 30, and I think Madison and Transylvania rank around number 70 in the state in their response rate. So we need to encourage more people to respond to the census. And just remind them, if someone doesn't respond, then somebody's going to come knocking on their door. So I know people want to try to avoid that if they can. Drew, if you could respond to one question, and want to remind everyone, if you have any questions for any of the presenters, you can add that to the chat box. And also, you can text me at 828-768-3216. That's 828-768-3216. But Drew, you mentioned increased hospitalizations. It's my understanding that I think what Governor Cooper is very concerned with is certainly more testing's being done, so more the number of cases are increasing, and that would follow because partly more testing is happening. But the percentage of positives, the total number of tests, that number's actually been holding steady or actually increasing. Is that correct? And is that really, you know, what the governor is concerned with?
Yes, that's another key factor there, that the percentage of positive tests are increasing as well. So, yes, we would expect, as anybody would, that the total number of tests would increase, or total number of positive cases would increase, because we're testing more. But the fact that the percentage is not holding level or decreasing is worrying. And so the Governor Cooper and Secretary Cohen are looking at those metrics along with the other key factors and trying to evaluate everything there.
Thank you so much, Drew. And I saw in the chat box, and maybe you can respond to Erica's question, but you gave some breakdowns of numbers that if we don't increase our response rates, here's the financial impact to our counties and local governments, so and municipalities. And if you could share that, we would be very grateful.
Absolutely.
Now I'd like to turn the call over to Chris Wall with EQB Strategic. And Chris is very gracious to join us today. He is going to give us an update about state and federal legislation and potential impacts for our region. So, Chris, are you on the call?
I am. Nathan, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. You're loud and clear. Thank you, Chris, for joining us today.
Great. Always happy to join. And I would just like to echo what Drew said about the census. I know for you guys on the local level, it means dollars. But also on a macro level, it can make or break North Carolina picking up congressional seats. I think, you know, North Carolina is expected to get one more congressional seat. We have 13 right now. I think it's widely accepted that we're going to get 14, and we may even get 15. But the census is a huge factor into our representation in Washington, D.C. So always encourage everyone to fill that out. And speaking of Washington, D.C., as far as it relates to COVID relief and the next iteration of federal assistance to come out of Washington, D.C., I think the last time I was on, we talked, we're still waiting on the United States Senate to formalize a plan, a COVID Part 4 package or response to what the House of Representatives have passed in the HEROES Act. That has taken a little bit of a back seat due to recent events. The Senate has turned its attention to police reform legislation that they are currently working on right now. And there's also a National Defense Authorization Act that the Senate needs to get out quickly as well. So I'm hopeful that we will still see a COVID Part 4 package from the Senate sometime in July. But I think now where we thought we would get it by July 4th, it looks like it probably will be toward the end of July before we see the Senate pass a bill and then enter into negotiations with the House. Again, I think the timeline for the next federal package is still looking September or October. It's just the Senate has turned to other issues to deal with here in the short term. So again, you know, we're status quo in Washington, D.C. We'll keep our eye on that and, of course, let you know when we hear any movement. And Joe may even have a few more updates for you on that when he speaks. But back on the state level, It's been interesting. I think the General Assembly has been resigned to the fact that they, for some time now, the money that they were holding back from the CARES funding in reserve, they have been working with Department of Treasury and asking Congress to give them more flexibility in how to use those COVID dollars that the federal government sent. And I think the General Assembly is resigned to the fact that that flexibility is not coming soon. And I think Treasury has told them that Congress will have to give them the ability to allow for more flexibility, and that won't happen until we see a COVID Part 4 package. So again, that flexibility probably isn't coming for several more months. Because of that, you've seen the House and the Senate start to spend or appropriate the rest of the dollars in CARES. In fact, there was a big bill that moved through the Senate this week that I think took $684 million and used that to backfill state budget holes in the forms of salaries, equipment, a lot of resources that were dedicated from the state standpoint to COVID. They're using those funds to backfill the cost and to plug some budget shortfalls. One other interesting thing of note that moved through the Senate this week, and I know is being contemplated in the House, is what they are calling a business stimulus package. And it is for that middle tier business that didn't qualify for any of the previous programs, so PPP or the New Market Loan Program or the Golden Leaf Program that Drew mentioned. And so there's $200 million in that those companies that haven't been eligible for assistance would be. But one of the biggest reasons I bring it up is that legislation also creates a new pot of money called the local government investment fund. And that those monies would go to local governments to help businesses grow and expand. So think of it as an additional incentive package that will be at your disposal. And I think initially there's not a tremendous amount of money in it, several million dollars, but they keep putting for all these unspent COVID funds, if they aren't spent by a certain date, then they revert to that new local government investment fund. So you could actually see that with some fairly significant funds. So again, that's moved through the House. The Senate, I know, is talking. That's moved through the Senate. The House is talking about a similar proposal, but they have not introduced any legislation. I think all of that will be part of what we keep anticipating coming next week is the state's second COVID package, which they will expend. Probably the majority of the CARES funds that they still have in reserve. I was told yesterday that there's around $972 million that they could put into local governments and the economy to help folks, again, just dig out of the pandemic and with the response. So we fully anticipate to see that next week. We also think that next week will be the end of the General Assembly. They are working to only be in next week. And I think maybe I'd mentioned the last time they may have a budget and a COVID package. That's not going to be the case anymore. It's just going to be one large spending package. So there won't be two appropriate bills moving through the General Assembly at once. But you'll look for that to come next week. We thought it may come this week, but that didn't materialize. And I think, Nathan, those are probably the big ticket items. Oh, there was one other one there. There's a water resource bill that was a part of the budget last year that set up what's called the Viable Utility Fund, and it's for local governments to help deal with aging water and wastewater treatment systems. And it provides funds for planning, refurbishment, or in some cases, if they, consolidation. So that bill has been resurrected. Obviously, we didn't get a budget last year, so that bill has been resurrected and is currently working through the General Assembly as well. So there's a couple of things coming down for local governments that I think will be a big help to folks, especially as, again, we're still working through the pandemic and trying to get through this. I think those are the big ticket items right now, Nathan. And again, always happy to answer any questions about what I've talked about or anything that I haven't talked about.
Thank you so much, Chris, for that update. And I appreciate you mentioning about the utility fund. There had been some talk about a bond for schools, possible transportation, water, sewer. Is there still ongoing discussion about a possible bond referendum?
Yeah, sorry. I left that out. That was in committee yesterday and passed, and I haven't checked the House. It may be the House is voting today and tomorrow, and I expect that to pass the House either this afternoon or tomorrow and then go to the Senate. I think if you remember last year when they were working on this, the Senate was a little more cautious or a little less reticent to pass, but this is a priority of the Speaker of the House. So, you have to take that very seriously, but it was discussed and look for that to pass the House either today or tomorrow.
And does that bond still include schools and infrastructure?
Yes, it does. And transportation. That's to help DOT with their budget shortfalls as well.
You know if there's a community college component of the schools or is it just K-12?
No, it's K-12 community colleges and university system.
Okay, so it includes all levels of education. Well, thanks, Chris, for that clarification. You mentioned that business stimulus package that was coming through the General Assembly. You know, if an organization is a nonprofit, maybe a healthcare provider or other, maybe they have a large number of employees, would those businesses be or organizations be eligible, or is it just for-profit businesses? Or
no,
you don't know, that's okay.
Yes, no, nonprofits were actually added through an amendment yesterday in committee, so nonprofits would be eligible as well. Again, the criteria would be, though, you could not have received any federal or state assistance previously. And there is no restriction on size, so whether you're a company of 20 employees or 2,000, as long as you have not received, there are a couple of other parameters. You have to have a decrease in revenue of at least 10% from the same time period the year prior, and you must have retained at least 90% of your staff to be eligible. So if you meet, and I think those are the three main criteria. So if you meet those three criteria, you are eligible, and that does include nonprofits.
And you mentioned to us about state and local government relief and the effort to try to get some more clarity from the federal government to get regarding flexibility of the funds that were in the CARES Act. Do you anticipate there will be additional, and I know when the Senate comes out toward the end of July with some bill, that there will be a state and local government relief part of that will help offset revenue losses, because in large part that first piece would not allow you to supplant or to replace if it was just, a revenue loss.
Yeah, I think, again, we've talked about this. That has been the message from, almost the majority of states, right, that we need this flexibility. And that message has been received on Capitol Hill. I think it is difficult to see a scenario where that is not the federal government does not address that in some form or fashion.
And final question, Chris, and I apologize for so many questions, but NCDOT has faced many challenges and has significant budget shortfalls. Is there going to be an effort to resolve that, because we're starting to see significant reductions in projects, local projects that haven't been where the contracts haven't been led. A lot of those are being pulled back. So what's the latest update from NCDOT?
That is still a somewhat of a political football right now. The General Assembly yesterday, I apologize, I can't remember if the bill was just introduced or if it made its way through committee, but it changed some of the governor's appointment powers for the DOT advisory board. Obviously, we've seen that that move before from the General Assembly, which usually elicits some sort of legal action from the governor, because they, you know, he will contend that it's unconstitutional. So far, the governor has been mostly, I think, probably 100% successful on the majority of his lawsuits against the General Assembly when they try to take powers away. But inevitably, you know, what that does is that adds time to the situation. There have been a number of proposals to fill the DOT budget shortfall, but for various reasons, haven't completely made it through the process. And then just to, you know, just kind of continue stirring the pot a little bit, you had Auditor Beth Woods report that the General Assembly was focused on 2 weeks ago, which really didn't paint the DOT in a great light, right? I don't think I can really characterize it any other way. So all these things are factoring and swirling into what's happening with DOT. And I think the net effect of it is, I don't know the answer to your question, Nathan. It's just, we'll just have to see how all these things play out.
Chris, you did a great job as always. We really appreciate you keeping us informed, and thank you for, I know it's a busy day for you, so thank you for spending some time with us.
You got it. Thank you.
And we'll turn it over later on to Joe McKinney, and he can back clean up. So he'll make sure everything in D.C., all those things that we're trying to get accomplished happen. So we'll talk to Joe later on in this call. Now we're honored to have Thomas Stith, who is the North Carolina District Director for the SBA. Director Stith has a long history of public service in North Carolina, and he has been in this role for, I think, just a little over the past year, but Director Stith can clarify me on that. But I think, I don't know when you were appointed to this position that you knew that you would be in on the firing line with so many different programs, and this is a significant workload for you and your team. So, Director Stith, thank you for being with us. And we do have your slide on the screen.
Okay. Well, first and foremost, Nathan, let me say thank you for the opportunity to join the call today. And thank you for your leadership. We, as you said, as a lifelong North Carolinian, I realize the value and need for the Land of Sky Regional Council, and just appreciate your leadership, and in particular for our western part of the state. And I was chuckling, it hasn't quite been a year, it'll be a year, September 30th of this year, when I was sworn in as district director, but I can assure you it seems like 10 years now that we have faced, for our state and country has been just an unprecedented crisis. And I would like to thank, and you did mention the team, and I know Sharon Harvey is our senior area manager located there in Asheville and covers the western part of the state and has done just an excellent job working for our district office efforts. So again, want to just thank you and just talk through a couple of key items that SBA has been implementing since the onset of this pandemic. And I appreciate your team receiving the slides, and we will work through the technology with some of the restrictions from SBA. I can't actually visually see what you see, but I have my PowerPoint up on my end. Just to level set, if we're starting off with the blue SBA logo screen, we will call that slide one. And so let's go to slide two, which would be an overview of the SBA assistance for small businesses. And today I want to talk about really three of our initiatives, but really drill down and talk about two key responses from SBA. First and foremost, the Paycheck Protection Program. And I want to say and make it clear and have a sense of urgency that there is still funding remaining in the Paycheck Protection Program. there's over $100 billion available for small businesses and nonprofits that may not have applied to the Paycheck Protection Program. This is an initiative that is coordinated with local lenders, banks, credit unions, and fintech companies that actually will work with small businesses and nonprofits. SBA guarantees these loans, but these loans have a key component, and they are designed to provide much needed financial support for small businesses and nonprofits to maintain their payroll, maintain jobs, and also provide a component for ongoing operating expenses such as rent, lease payments, mortgage interest. There was a recent change in the Paycheck Protection Program. You know, we've had a couple of rounds of funding for this, but on June the 5th, the Paycheck Protection Flexibility Act was passed by Congress and signed by the president, and it provides even more flexibility for the small business owner. The original cover period to review for potential forgiveness of the loan initially was 8 weeks. Now small businesses have 24 weeks to expend the funds. Once they receive a Paycheck Protection loan, instead of 8 week review period, there's a 24 week period to expend those funds on allowable expenses. And that is another component that has been modified. Originally, 75% was the threshold for forgiveness to pay to expend on payroll and payroll costs, 25% for other allowable uses such as rent and utility payments. With the Flexibility Act passage, now it is a 60% minimum and 60% for payroll expenses and 40% for other allowable expenses such as rent and utilities. Those loans that are made after June 5th will now have a 5-year term for any portion that is not forgiven for 1 year. Those made before the borrower and the lender can agree to an extension to 5 years, but those that are made after June the 5th, we have an automatic 5-year for any funds that are not forgiven. So this is a key tool that is available now. Applications have to be approved by June the 30th. And so that's why we're really encouraging small businesses or nonprofits that have not taken advantage of this initiative to review it. Our North Carolina district website, and that's sba.gov/NC, has information on various lenders. Because that was another challenge. Some small businesses didn't have banking relationships. So we have developed a list of banks that will provide PPP loans. And there are some that have stopped accepting applications, but we have a very robust list that can provide a source for potential Paycheck Protection Program small businesses. And we'll talk about the results in just a moment. The other initiative is the economic injury disaster loans. And this actually came into effect before the passage of the CARES Act. North Carolina was declared the full state in an emergency or disaster zone, and which allowed our small businesses and nonprofits to apply for economic injury disaster loan. These are direct loans with SBA, and they provide general operating expenses, a loan for operating expenses. After the passage of the CARES Act, there was an accompanying advance, and that was up to $10,000 could be received by a small business if approved. And the rule of thumb was $1,000 per employee up to $10,000. That portal for the economic injury disaster loan had been closed, except for agriculture concerns over the last several weeks, just because of the significant demand. But as of this week, that portal has reopened. And so all eligible nonprofits and small businesses can now apply if they are not already under review. If you have already applied, there's no need to reapply. So those two tools, both the economic injury disaster loan and the paycheck protection loan, are designed to provide economic support and financial support for our small business community. A third initiative that hasn't gotten as much notoriety, but is very important just the same for our existing SBA loan recipients, and that's the Small Business Debt Relief Program, which literally provides 6 months worth of interest and principal payments deferred for the small business. Those payments are actually paid by SBA, and those are on our traditional loans, the 7A and 504 loans. So if you're a small business that has an existing SBA loan, a 7A, 504, or microloan, that is something that you could pursue, and that would provide 6 months of relief for interest and principal payments. So let's take a moment and talk about the results from the Paycheck Protection Program, and that will be on the next slide. And I want to just say it has been very beneficial for North Carolina. As you can see, over $12 billion have been approved so far for over 114,000 small businesses and nonprofits in North Carolina. This has been a significant financial infusion into our state. Obviously, we still have a significant challenge before us, and that is the other reason to continue to encourage small businesses, if they have a situation that a paycheck protection loan would be a benefit, to please to seek out a lender now. There is still existing funding. We also see, as the program continued to be implemented, a smaller average loan amount. And this is letting us know that with the second round of funding, we're getting to the smaller business, smaller nonprofit in some of our underserved areas. The average loan size now is about $111,000. The initial round of funding we saw, that was well over $200,000. And the number of loans are significantly increased from the first round of funding. So while we think some of the strategic decisions for the second round of funding provided smaller lenders, our community development financial institutions, our minority development depository institutions, actually had a dedication of $60 billion during the initial phase of the second round of funding. Over the last several weeks, $10 billion has been designated to those smaller lenders. So with the Paycheck Protection Program, we're seeing excellent results here in North Carolina. We realize there's still a significant need, and encourage small businesses to pursue at least follow up, finding information out with your lender about the potential for a paycheck protection loan. On the next slide, we see the results so far for the economic injury disaster loan. And again, there was significant demand and response from the economic injury disaster loan, but we are starting to see results. Over $2 billion worth of loans have been approved so far in North Carolina. That's a little over 33,000 recipients. For the full economic injury disaster loans. And those are longer term. Those are up to 30 years at 3.75% and can be utilized, as I mentioned earlier, for general operating expenses. The economic injury advance, those are literally grants. And so those do not have to be repaid if approved. And as I mentioned, those are up to $10,000 depending on your number of employees. But again, here in North Carolina, we're seeing a good financial support for our small businesses. A little over $282 million so far have been approved. A little over 82,000 applicants have been approved. And again, that economic injury disaster loan portal reopened this week, and that is available for all small businesses and nonprofits. And when we say nonprofits, we include faith-based organizations as well. Certainly encourage individuals, and we know, again, significant demand. We have over 900,000 small businesses in North Carolina, and they employ a little over 1.7 million people. So we know we have a small business community that is important to our economy, And more importantly, they're important to the communities that they serve. So Nathan, with that, I'll just conclude and say, you know, it has been SBA's mission even before COVID-19 to be very engaged with the small business community here in North Carolina, helping to start, grow, and expand our small businesses to assist during a disaster for recovery. We're very engaged during this pandemic, and our goal and commitment will be to stay involved throughout recovery and past as we work with the small business community to help grow North Carolina's economy. So with that, certainly, if there are questions, be glad to entertain any questions.
Thank you so much, Director Smith. And just a few questions, and if you don't have the answer of that, that's okay. Earlier we saw, you know, there's a 500 employee limit on the PPP loans, and we have several small private colleges in our region that had students on work study programs, and I think those students ended up counting as far as their employees, and that got them over the 500 limit where they weren't eligible for PPP. Are you aware of this issue, and is there any efforts to try to address that, or for those colleges, will payroll protection not be an option for them?
Yeah, I had not heard that specific example, but I do know there is an option. Typically, it is 500 employees or lower, but they're also the alternative. And certainly, if you send me that information, I can have Sharon speak with those private universities. There is also a size standard based on a business, and or in this case, colleges. Industry codes and industry size. So there could be an alternative, and it's called the size standard, that may or may not be able to qualify them. But if you could provide that information to me, I will get Sharon engaged and see if there is any other potential for a PPP. If they do not qualify, we can certainly let them know as well, but we'll be glad to work with the schools to see if there are any other options.
Thank you so much, Director Stith. Could you elaborate a little more on your relationship with the CDFIs in North Carolina? So, you know, we have Carolina Small Business Fund, Mountain BizWorks, and some others in our region that are providing capital to small businesses. Many of those are women and minority-owned, historically underutilized businesses. Can you share how that relationship works?
Yes, and there has been a significant, especially with round two of the Paycheck Protection funding cycle, a realization that we needed to ensure that CDFIs and MDIs had a opportunity to access capital. So in the second round of funding, initially there was $60 billion set aside for smaller asset lending institutions. And most recently, $10 billion was specifically allocated for CDFIs. And the thought there is providing a dedicated pool of available funds for CDFIs to submit applications for, because you're correct. They are typically working with our smaller businesses, our underutilized businesses. And so there was a set of designation of $10 billion for CDFIs in particular. And then moving forward, we're looking at other strategies on how SBA and CDFIs and MDIs can work together in a collaborative manner. You know, on a national level, we don't have yet the specific North Carolina numbers. We're seeing results from that. CDFIs have approved loans of a little over $7 billion, MDIs a little over $10 billion. So we think some of the strategic initiatives specifically focused on that size lender is starting to have some results, but we plan to continue to focus. And as you mentioned, you know, Mountain BizWorks in particular has been very active with the SBA, and we plan to continue, obviously, to be a strong partner.
And Director Stiff, just two quick questions here to end this conversation. And again, we appreciate you joining us. If it's okay with you, and we can talk offline, if we can share your PowerPoint, if that's okay, we would like to be able to do that. But we can talk offline regarding that. There in the small business disaster laws, there's a provision about business relocation. Does that mean that the business cannot relocate within the same community, or is that just meaning they can't relocate to another state some other location beyond their existing community area? If you're familiar with that provision?
Not that specific provision. So I wouldn't want to, have my thoughts on that. But again, if I can have, we'll review that and I can give you a better answer. My thought would be it may be relocating out of the state, but I don't, let me find that out and I can certainly get you that answer back.
Okay. And that was a question submitted in our chat box. So, and finally, okay. On the PPP loans and EIDL, a business cannot take advantage of both of those grants. So if you get paycheck protection forgiveness, you cannot receive the advance in the EIDL. Is that correct?
You actually can. You're eligible for both loans. A business can, receive a economic injury disaster loan, a EIDL, and a paycheck protection program. The issue to focus on is you cannot use those proceeds for the same use. Obviously, with the paycheck protection program, you are going to want to maximize those use of funds now at least 60% if you want to trigger full forgiveness on payroll. So if you're a recipient of both, then strategically you will probably want to utilize proceeds from the PPP first and foremost to meet the threshold for forgiveness. With the economic injury disaster loan, payroll is an eligible expense, but again, you can't use it for the same reason. So you would want to look at other eligible operating expenses to utilize your EIDL loan proceeds for. So as long as you don't utilize them for the same reason or the same category, you can, you're eligible for both.
Thank you so much, Director Stiff, for joining us. And we just hope you stay safe and stay well, and appreciate everything you're doing for the state of North Carolina.
Well, thank you again for having me on. I'm welcome to come back at any time, and you as well. Please stay safe, and we will work through this this pandemic together. North Carolinians, as you know, are very resilient, and I'm seeing that now as I move around North Carolina, albeit virtually, that just the spirit of our state and the commitment to work together as a unified state is just refreshing, and I'm just glad to be a part of it. So you take care.
Thank you so much. Now I'd like to turn the call over to Joe McKinney. And Joe is our fearless leader in D.C., representing development organizations across the nation. Land of Sky is proud and honored to be a member of NATO. And for some context, Joe was the executive director at Land of Sky for many years. So Joe did a much better job here at Land of Sky than the current executive director. So Joe, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Nathan. Can you hear me okay?
I can, and thank you for taking Good. Time to join our call.
No problem. I'm calling from the Arden Satellite Office of NATO. I have actually been in Asheville since March 16th or so. When I left Land of Sky, I kept my residence in Asheville because I had five kids wanting to go to college in North Carolina. So I work in D.C. It's almost 8 years now, but I still call Asheville home, and I've been working here throughout the whole pandemic. So my board says I've done a good job here. They don't want me to come back. I don't know how to take that, but it has been great to be home during this time, and appreciate the chance to talk to you today. I see that I was going to say Mayor Bellamy. That's how I know Terry is Mayor Bellamy, and Jason Chappell are on the call, and just want to say hello to them. They served on the exec committee, and Terry was actually chair for a year when I was at Land of Sky, and they just provided so much support, and really appreciate their support when I was at Land of Sky, and want to say hello to them. Real quickly, I'm going to touch real briefly on NATO and who we are and kind of talk about what's happening on the Hill as best we can determine, and then close with a couple opportunities, I think, for Land of Sky to take a look at. But Nathan had mentioned NATO is not the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, although that's who my kids think I work for. It's actually the National Association of Development Organizations. And that essentially what we do is represent the more than 500 regional councils and councils of governments across the country. We go by development organizations because they go by so many different names across the country. Regional councils, council governments, economic development district, and so forth. But the umbrella is development, community economic development. And so that's kind of who we represent. As I said before, I've been at NATO almost 8 years. And the way I used NATO when I was in Nathan's seat was kind of having NATO serve as the eyes and ears in DC. I think Nathan could spend 100% of his time focusing on what's going on in DC, but I know he's charged with doing things on a regional basis. And so I always felt it was good to have a partner in DC that not only kind of looked out for the programs that regional councils provide, but also looked for opportunities. And that's what I've tried to do at NATO over the years. We represent all of the regional councils. They differ quite a bit, but the majority of our members are kind of rural communities and rural regions. We do have some regions that are urban in nature. We have Atlanta and we have Columbus, Ohio, and others that are joining because they want that kind of rural-urban mix and relationship. But NATO traditionally has looked out for the smaller counties and communities across the country, and that's continued to be our focus throughout this process. When COVID came down, it happened really quickly, but we were fortunate to have relationships across the country through our members and their House and Senate leadership that we were pretty quick in response. Our concern was that our economic development districts receive resources to help on the local level. And the one thing that Land of Sky, the services they provide that I'm sure you're aware, is through the Economic Development Administration, they receive some planning and technical assistance dollars annually to do support community economic development across your four counties and communities. I think normally, Nathan, that amount is about $70,000, $80,000 a year to do that. And so our focus initially in working with the leadership in the House and Senate was to make sure that there's funding provided. And I think things just worked out for us in that we had some really good relationships that we've built. The fact that Mark Meadows had moved to the White House and was familiar with EDA through his work in Congress, the fact that he brought over the current Assistant Secretary at EDA to serve on his staff at the White House kind of made them familiar with what you do and the work you do. And then Senator Schumer's office, we had some really good relationships there and with McConnell's office. It just was kind of the perfect storm for EDA to take a step up to help their communities. And we were fortunate. I think the normal allocation for EDA is around $350 million a year. And through the CARES Act, we were able to push forward essentially $1.5 billion, which is five times our normal funding, to help local communities address their challenges. And I know that each of the economic development districts across the country received about $400,000. I think normally that's $70,000 I mentioned. So it was a big win for us, and I think a big win for local and rural communities that you have an organization like Land of Sky there to help with the economic recovery that's going to be needed. In addition to that, there's some additional funding for some revolving loan programs, and I'll talk about that in just a bit when I close. But we've been fortunate. The big push now, as I'm sure you're aware, is the concern for local governments, counties, and cities, and the revenue challenges that they're going to face or are currently facing. As you know, I think that the House has passed their version of the fourth COVID relief called the HEROES Act, which includes significant funding to kind of backfill those lost revenues for state and local governments. The Senate has not taken that up yet. I think you're seeing more and more discussion that that's going to be addressed soon. You're hearing more that from both sides of the aisle that local governments are really in need and there needs to be some supplemental funding. That's what we are pushing for from an advocacy standpoint. We partner quite heavily with the National Association of Counties, the League of Cities, the Conference of Mayors, and others that represent local government interests to advocate for that. And I think we're going to see in the next month or so another round that will include some funding to help backfill those revenues that they're pretty scary that the local governments are losing. So that's our big focus right now is promoting the need for that for local governments. I'm well aware of the fiscal challenges on the national level. What I will say is that the federal dollars are your tax dollars that you've paid, and I do want to see those come back to your communities to help during this time. And so while we're cognizant of the federal fiscal challenges, there's a huge need on a local level to get your tax dollars back at work in your communities. In addition to that, as you know, there's a lot of talk about infrastructure. I know the administration, the president came out in the last couple of days promoting a big infrastructure package that he would like to see happen. In addition, the House and Senate are talking about surface transportation reauthorization and additional funding for transportation. The big challenge there, as everybody knows, is how to pay for it. The current system in place with the gas tax is not sustainable at all. It's fewer cars are on the road. You're seeing alternative uses, and so there has to be a kind of a new way to look at how to fund infrastructure and transportation, and that's the big sticking point. But it is good to hear that infrastructure is being talked about, because I think that's the one. One issue in D.C. that crosses party lines, that crosses both the House and Senate, is that need for infrastructure on a local level. And you know that as local elected officials and community leaders, that is a huge need. So it's good that we're talking about that. Where that goes, we really don't know. Some other things that I think have impacted the Land of Sky, certainly the passage of the Elder Americans Act reauthorization is something that we also helped partner with the National Area Agency on Aging to push through. A lot of our members do provide aging services in their communities, like I know Land of Sky does. It's always important to make sure that there's programs out there and there's funding available for the older members of our community. So also in addition to that, I just want to talk about a couple of opportunities, one of which I mentioned was a revolving loan fund with Economic Development Administration. And I'm pretty sure that Land of Sky does not operate an Economic Development Administration revolving loan fund. Nathan, at least when I was there, we did not. I don't know if you guys do now. The big holdup was if you get $1 million from if you get $1 million from the federal government under the normal appropriations process, you would have to match that with a local match of $1 million. It was a 50-50 match. And that was what prevented, I think, Land of Sky in the past from looking at getting in the revolving loan. Basically, that revolving loan fund is another tool for your industries and small businesses to have very low interest loans. We're talking 1%, 2%. And I know that the Asheville community in the Land of Sky region has a number of really good lending, nonprofit lending, but the revolving loan is specific to economic development districts like EDA. And with the supplemental funding, there's some competitive dollars that I think Land of Sky might want to take a look at for revolving loan, at least have that discussion with Hillary Sherman, your economic development rep, or Phil Paradise in Atlanta. And there's a possibility that you don't have to have that match, or you would have a much less of a match than 50-50 So I know that there's competitive dollars out there. So Nathan, that might be something that you might have Eric or others look at, is start that conversation with EDA. That I know that Land and Sky in the past has had a very, very successful brownfields revolving loan program, and it's similar to that in being able to reach your local businesses. But with the COVID funding that's out there, it might be an opportunity for Land and Sky to maybe take a look at that without having to come up with such a huge local match. And then the other thing that we've been working with our federal partners, and you may be aware of that, is that HUD has released some guidance during the COVID for community development block grants and subrecipients being able to receive direct funding. I know in the past, CDBG normally flows through your local governments, and a number of those contract with their regional councils and others for service delivery. But during this COVID process, HUD has agreed that if it's the desire of the local governments, that the money can flow directly to the economic development or to the regional councils and the subrecipients. I know that local governments have their hands full with a lot of things right now, and they look to organizations like Land and Sky to help with service provision. So with COVID, that previous requirement that subrecipients don't receive direct funding has been waived. So that's something else that you might want to take a look at as well. So I know that we're running short on time, but I just, again, Nathan, I appreciate the opportunity just to pop in and say hello to friends, and also kind of bring you an update of what we're working on in D.C. on behalf of regional councils across the country.
Well, we appreciate there's an Arden office to NATO and you being here you can work from home. And Joe, thanks to you and all your team for your work on our behalf and our local governments. Just one question, one thing that's come up on these calls often is broadband, from our education leaders, economic development leaders, the need for broadband. We knew before COVID-19 that was a great need, but that has been accentuated through the need to work from home and to telework during this time. Do you have a sense at the federal level of any support, especially for our smaller counties, rural counties like Madison and Transylvania, to really help them with their broadband needs?
Yeah, that's I hear broadband every day from our members, and I'm also now starting to hear it on the Hill. The challenge that I know that you're faced with, and particularly in smaller communities, is there's no real central source of funding for broadband. There's different agencies have different pots of money, and it's hard to piece together a project that can have impact on all these funding. And so the thing we're hearing on the federal level is looking at centralizing funding for broadband, specifically rural broadband, where there is a bigger pool of money available, and it is kind of centralized into one organization and one agency instead of it being spread out over a number of agencies. But broadband is by far what we're hearing is the number one need, and I think that's resonating in Congress during this time.
Do you think there'll be additional funding following that, or is that, I know the challenge with broadband, it's like if our region had $1 million for broadband, that would be helpful, but to meet the need, it's really a drop in the bucket, and you're working with private providers and others to try to leverage those funds. Do you think there's the willingness, as you said, the federal government's facing, they've committed trillions of dollars through the CARES Act, probably will be another significant commitment, but do you think that financial commitment is, that desire is there on behalf of broadband, or do they not quite know what the solution should be right now, so they're still grappling with that?
I think they're still wrestling, but I do think there's a commitment to provide some funding. I know that the 21 appropriations process has already started or is up is starting, and we're hearing a lot from EDA of having a rural broadband initiative. I know there's a bill that's been introduced to allow a wider usage of EDA funding for rural broadband. In the past, EDA's used those dollars primarily for technical assistance and kind of studies and things like that, and not really the hard cost of providing rural broadband. So I do think that there's going to be funding. I don't know if it's necessarily going to be in the next COVID Act, but I think in the 21 appropriations process, we'll see an emphasis on rural broadband.
Joe, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate everybody who took their time to join us on today's call. We'll try to post these resources that were shared on today's call on our Land of Sky website. It's about 5 minutes after two, and we try to end these calls within an hour, so we're a few minutes over. But we apologize for that, but we hope everyone has a wonderful day. Stay safe, stay well, and we'll continue these calls every Thursday at 1 o'clock as long as we're in this environment of this public health and economic crisis. So thanks to everyone for all your work across our region and state, and have a wonderful day.